Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everybody. This is Sam, host of Open World, formerly known as Against the Grain. And we are back this Friday, another wonderful Friday. Hopefully y'all can hear me. I don't know what's been going on with these headphones lately. It might just be time that I got to pick up another pair because I destroy headphones like it is absolutely nobody's business. We're waiting for Pixie to call in because he has some stuff that he wants to go over with us today. And then Rod will be joining us today as well. I'm just firing up a couple things here. I will be out in my garden this evening watering because I have got to get this garden watered. It has been a very busy past little while. That's really all I'm gonna say. For the moment, give me a couple seconds here, guys. One more second here. Come on, Pixie, message back here, buddy. Oh, somebody got offended and they defended me. That's kind of cute. I love it when people defend you over silly posts, especially people that have been your friends for a long time. There's a lot of people out there that get butthurt over some really ridiculous stuff. You know what, guys? I'm going to have to give Pixie a quick call here. Give me one second. Don't mind my kids in the background. Okay, just give me one second here. I'm going to give them a quick call.
Hello?
There you are.
Hello?
Hi.
Hey, I'm here.
You can hear me okay?
Yeah, are we live?
We are live. I'm just going to pod on, well, I'm going to be watering my garden while I'm doing my radio show today because the house is currently out of the water and my water tank on the back of the truck is currently full of water for my garden, so I'm multitasking today. And
that's amazing.
That's my one. Rod, are you there as well?
Yes.
Perfect.
Yes.
Okay.
Hey, Rod.
I'm going to be heading outside here. And Pixie has got some updates for us today, and I'm sure Rod is going to want to chime in as well because he's always got something very amazing to say. So
I love talking to Rob. unfortunately, I'm actually on my way back from the store, so it's going to be probably about 5 minutes before I'm in front of my computer. I'm in my driveway now. But we did have some interesting developments this week. We are now on the offense instead of the defense. And it's official. So it's pretty cool that we're no longer, I mean, we're still doing some defense on some other issues, but we did, we filed a restraining order, a civil no contact order, as they call it in North Carolina, against the Department of Social Services. Three specific named individuals, the Department of Social Services itself, and DOES 1 through 250, because we got word from the county clerk that there are about 250 employees working for that particular agency. So we're doing okay. And the criminal case that we were talking about before, the next hearing for that is August 14th. But when we got our no contact order, our basically it's a restraining order, along with a request for either a writ of prohibition or an injunction, we didn't give a rat's butt what the court decided to call it. We told them, we don't want this agency doing this thing, and we want you to stop them immediately. So we have that filed, and that the hearing for that is actually on August 10th, which is 4 days before the criminal case, that they're intending to use all of that agency's information as evidence for. So we're in pretty good shape there, and we're now on the attack instead of on the defense. Although, again, we are still working on the defense as a separate issue, because you can't ever give up on that. But it's fun to be on the offensive side of this now. Rob, before I even go any further, I'm sure you have something to put in.
I was just thinking of another guided meditation. I hadn't had another subject matter, but if you pick a subject, I might have something to say.
Can you repeat that? I'm sorry, I missed you.
I said I didn't.
I'm just pulling into my driveway. I'm sorry.
Right. There's a fellow named Gabor Maté. There was a Zsa Zsa Gabor many years ago, and she's Hungarian, and this guy is Hungarian, so it's a Hungarian name, Gabor, and Maté, and he wrote some books about trauma and addiction. He's got some interesting quotations. He says that all addictions are caused by early trauma, which other people dispute, but he wrote a book titled "When the Body Says No," and that's about, I guess, it's just about when your unconscious has had enough of whatever it is that's going on and just won't participate, so your body gets sick.
Well, I do have a few addictions.
And that general subject is connected to my interest in how to think for success, because it's a distraction. It's a model for other distractions. And there's an element of economics in it, because there's a thing called the interest rate or the discount rate. How much do you like the future versus how much do you like now? Would you rather have a dollar now or a dollar a year from now? Well, obviously, you'd rather have a dollar now. You don't have to wait. But would you rather have a dollar now, or would you rather have a dollar six a year from now? Well, it depends on whether your discount rate is more or less than 6%.
Right.
So if your discount rate is more than 6%, then you like the future more than you like the present, and you're more likely to be a lender. Whereas it's the other way around, you're more likely to be a borrower. And so an addiction is when you like the present so much, you're going to enjoy this fleeting thing and put up with the damage that occurs in the future. Whereas if you're more future-oriented, then you say, well, it's not worth it.
That makes sense.
That sounds funny.
I have a couple of addictions, but I'll tell you what the most important one to me is keeping people out of boxes. And although I have a couple of other addictions that might detract from that on time and occasion, the main addiction I have is keeping the people out of boxes. And I don't ever stop moving forward, and I don't ever stop getting results. You know, I mean, right now, I just got home, so I'm going to pull up this folder. Oh, that's the wrong one.
You just inside now?
What's that?
You just got inside now?
Yeah, just now.
Okay, perfect. Then we'll go over your stuff, and then we're definitely going to revisit the stuff on the addictions after you've kind of gone over some of your stuff. So I think this would be, both are going to be a really interesting conversation. So because if you got your stuff pulled up, we'll go over that, and then we're going to go over Rod's stuff here, because he's always got something, you guys have always got something interesting to say. I love it that you're just like, hey, can we come in? Can we share a thing? It's like, yeah, I know. I'm right now watering a garden and checking to see how many cabbage butterflies are destroying my cabbages. So, like, I will definitely take what you guys have to say right now, because I'm not going to lie, I am entirely unprepared.
Well, Sam, I have to admit, you are one of the greatest moderators on the face of the planet. And and I always enjoy talking to Rod, because, like, you know, I think I said this before, I learn a lot from him, and
yeah.
And I just appreciate him even being here and listening to the insane things that I do and put out there, because he always has a really good viewpoint on it, and is I have a lot of respect for that.
Big time.
What we did was a verified complaint for a civil no contact order in accordance with North Carolina General Statutes 50C-2 and petition for writ of prohibition or injunction. That's how we titled it, because we're not lawyers. We don't know what the hell we're talking about, right? So just give us what we want. Whether it's a writ of prohibition or an injunction, we don't care what you call it. We just want these people to stop from putting his name on that RIL, that Responsible as Individuals list, which I think we discussed before, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So we went in there and we basically filed a restraining order. We did a judicial notice at the very beginning of it. We listed all of the statutes that the plaintiff is violating. So let me scroll past that, because we're not going to get into all that. The statute numbers are kind of irrelevant. Yeah, most people can look them up for themselves.
And what you need most is the facts, of course. What did they do?
My apologies. What did you say?
What you need most, of course, is the facts. What do they do? Because the judges know the statutes pretty well.
Right.
Right,
right, yeah. So precisely why I'm not going to go over that first two pages of judicial notice on the statutes. I'm going to get into the facts of the case section of this petition that we filed. There's two general sections of it. One of them was had to deal with witness tampering, and the other one had to do with some other stuff. Okay, so on or about 11-19-2022, defendant Randolph County Department of Social Services visited the plaintiff's house at such and such. A temporary CPS worker, whom the plaintiff believes was, and we put the name, arrived at the house in November and verbally stated, quote, everything looks safe. And mind you, we have this, I won't quote anything that's not already in a written affidavit. And verbally stated, quote, everything looks safe, but we need to work on a family plan, and, quote, if I thought there was an issue, I would come back with a child car seat. Okay. That's a form of a threat, but we're just, you know, stating facts here. Hold on. Let me get back down here. During the visit, the temporary worker stated that, quote, nothing you sign at this point will be used in court. Plaintiff believes that statements such as were made by the temporary worker fall within the false pretenses portion of acts prohibited by government agents under the Supreme Court case U.S. versus Wheel, right? Because you can't say that nothing you're going to say is, if nothing I'm going to say is going to be used in court, then why are you here? Anyway, in late December, defendant Donovan, which is one of the husband and wife team, visited the house to check up on the that works for CPS, mind you. There's a Donovan and a Tondria Waddell, and their husband and wife, and we've gotten their actual we got their pay. We found out from the county clerks how they received their pay. The husband receives 99% of his $52,000 a year salary from federal funds. The wife receives 73% of her $54,000 a year salary from federal funds, 20-something percent from county funds, and whatever excess percent from local funds. And then we found out that the deputy director of that agency receives his funds from both county and federal. Anyway, the reason we track that down is because if somebody's getting 99.9% of their salary from federal funds, that makes them a federal employee. And if they're a federal employee, then we have every right to go after them in federal court, which is what we were looking for. And that's kind of irrelevant as to what's going on right now. But I just wanted to add that we did find out where all of their paychecks were coming from, whether it be county, local, or state, or federal funds. We did track all that down. We got the county clerk to give us a rundown on all that by name and by salary and by title. So that was pretty cool. In late December, defendant Donovan Waddell visited the house to check up on kids again. At this visit, defendant Donovan Waddell stated to the mother that she needed to file a 50B, which is a domestic violence restraining order in North Carolina. It's called a 50B. Or that the defendant, Randolph County Department of Social Services, would take hers and the plaintiff's children from the home. Defendant Donovan Waddell was aware at this time that the plaintiff had been arrested, and there was a pending criminal court case in which the plaintiff's wife, the child's mother, was most likely to be called as a witness. At a meeting with the Family Crisis Center, the workers there explained to the mother that she could not file the 50B because she clearly told them that the plaintiff, my client, never touched her or the kids. So she was ordered to go to this Family Crisis Counseling Center to file for assistance with filing the domestic restraining order. Okay, and the Family Crisis Center told her that she can't file it because she told them that he never touched her or the kids. And the Family Crisis Counselor Center was like, you can't file this unless he's like beat you or anything. And she's like, no, that never happened. And they were like, well, did he touch your kids? And she was like, no, of course not. And so the Family Crisis Center people were saying, you can't legally file this 50B restraining order. Although CPS was telling her if she didn't file that restraining order, that they were going to take her kids away. All right, so, however, the mother did request the Family Crisis Center's assistance in filling out the 50B paperwork due to fear that the defendant, Donovan Waddell, would make good on his threats to have the defendant, Department of Social Services, forcibly remove her and the plaintiff's children from their home. After the 50B hearing, held before Judge such and such on January such and such was dismissed for failure to state a claim because she refused to show up and prosecute it. Employees, which are defendant Doe's, of defendant RCDSS, which is the Randolph County Department of Social Services, once again told Ms. the mother that she would be required to sign an agreement or risk having hers and the plaintiff's children removed from her care. On page 7 of the agreement, defendant Donovan Waddell stated as a term of the agreement that the mother was not permitted to allow the plaintiff to have any contact with the plaintiff's child. Okay, so basically what happened is they forced her to file this restraining order, even though the people she asked, they told her to get help from, said she shouldn't and couldn't. But she did, and then she didn't show up for court because none of it was true. And then because she didn't show up for court and the restraining order was dismissed, DSS came back after the mother and said, well, if you don't sign this agreement saying that you're not going to have any contact with the child's mother, then we're going to take the kids. Okay, so basically what they did is they subverted the court order and made her agree to that anyway. Even though there was no evidence ever that a restraining order should have been issued, they said, if you don't sign this private agreement with Child Services, basically saying the same thing as the restraining order, then we'll take your kids. So they said, file this restraining order or we'll take your kids. She filed the restraining order even though she wasn't supposed to legally and lawfully. And then that was dismissed. And then Child Support was like, we'll sign this private agreement that says, you know, that you can't, you know, basically the same thing, or we'll take your kids. So this is twice they threatened to take her kids if she didn't agree to no contact.
Isn't that kind of like everything under the whole, like, color of law thing, that it's just, like, you're literally going against, like, the actual ruling and everything?
Yes. This is the first part of what gave rise to this restraining order, this one that we filed.
Mm-hmm.
Because, yes, you're absolutely right, Sam. Okay. So defendant Donovan Waddell therefore effectively bypassed the ruling of a sitting judge in the 50B case with the restraining order, domestic violence restraining order, in order to obtain the same results against the plaintiff and his child through means of intimidation, threats, and extortion. If the agreement were actually enforceable, there would have been no need for Mrs. Moore to file the 50B against the plaintiff. Right? So we called it to the court's attention that, hey, if they could affect the same results through this signed agreement, then why did they try to get her to commit perjury in open court? I mean, it makes sense. If you could sign an agreement with them that effectively creates the same result, then why do you need to go to court to get a judge to order something? All right. Defendant Donovan Waddell used threats against the plaintiff's child to force the mother to engage in the unfounded creation of unnecessary public debt. That's what we wrote. On or about mid-June, the mother attended a family crisis meeting at defendant Department of Social Services offices, in which defendant Donovan Waddell stated that he was made aware of over 200 photos taken of the mother's daughter, which is the plaintiff's stepdaughter. Some of which included the minor child posing on a bed. Defendant Donovan Waddell stated that he had received information from law enforcement personnel. This information is stated in a document that the mother was required to sign,
once again under threat that if she did not sign it, that the social services would remove hers and the plaintiff's children from the home. All right. Hold on.
Explain that never happened.
Now, mind you, none of this ever happened because the original case is from the DA has 11 counts of felony peeping statute that doesn't even apply to this particular incident. Because, look, I have done a lot of research on this client.
The friends
I've dealt with friends of his, family of his, people in other states. I've talked to him on multiple occasions. I have no reason to believe that any of this nonsense is true. Okay? None whatsoever. And including the fact that the mother and the child supposedly being used as a weapon here, has the child swore under oath that he never touched her.
Or
taken photos of her, much less on a bed. This is all just crap being spewed from an agency. There was a camera in the bathroom because the father was afraid that the mother was cheating on him. So he put a camera in the bathroom. There was 11 photos of the child, the 14-year-old girl or whatever, taking a shower in that bathroom. It wasn't her bathroom, but she was taking a shower in the mother's bathroom. And so there was 11 photos caught by the camera. And everybody's like, even the mother is like, dude, this is ridiculous. Like, as soon as we brought it to his attention, years before this case started, mind you, this crap happened 2-3 years ago, and this case is just now happening now. Because the government is stepping in going, well, you owe us. Well, look, the child's mother brought it, like, they all knew what happened. They all agreed that it was screwed up, and the dad, like, immediately deleted all those pictures. Okay, years ago. This is years ago. They were like, oh, shit, I didn't do it. And the statutes were, the statutes that they're charging him under are, it specifically states in the statutes, photos taken for the purpose of, and it doesn't matter what the statutory purposes of were, but the fact is that he deleted the photos immediately as soon as he found out he had them, and therefore could not have been used for the purposes the statute is trying to charge him with. This is a very complex situation. It's the fact of the matter is the mother, the daughter, the plaintiff, nobody wants any of this. And nobody did anything wrong. There was a mistake that was immediately rectified years ago. And now the state is just trying to get theirs out of it. Nobody, look, the mother, the dad, the stepdaughter, none of them. Nobody wants any of this.
I just kind of want to know, I mean, off topic and speculation here, I kind of want to know, like, you know, there's certain times when, like, the state goes after the family. It's like, but, like, is this a well-off family or something that they're going after them? Because it's kind of weird that, like, there's so many cut-dry cases, or there's ones that it's like you could do a little investigating and then you die, you get this guy, and, like, shit's actually happening. But, like, they're just after this guy and for what? Like, I mean,
yeah,
I know
no,
it's like
this
state
is,
gets
no,
scared,
it,
so I'm
it,
like,
it,
I want to know what the hell the motive is here. Like, speculation-wise, obviously.
Well, the motive of the state is to do what the state always does, which is take everything from everybody. Mm. You know, Sam, I'll be honest with you. If these people had any money, they probably wouldn't be facing this problem.
Because, like, I've seen, like, quite a few court cases where, like, the government comes after these people's kids. They take the kids away. The family fights. They pay, like, you know, $50,000, $100,000, $500,000, $1 million. And then a year to 3 years later, finally get their kids back after their bank accounts have been completely bled dry.
Yes, this is very much what's happening in this case, actually. The plaintiff in this case, which is the defendant in a criminal case, his family has been sucked dry. They are very much sucking the family dry. They're sucking his mother dry. They're sucking the wife dry. They're basically making it so that the house that the kids are growing up in and living with their mother. Look, the mother and the father were separating. This was something that was already in the works, you know.
Yeah.
But they both had a very good agreement that was working for them as far as taking care of their kids, paying for the house. He was doing everything he was supposed to do, and now the government stepped in and it's all at risk. The mother is at threat of losing her house because the father that was paying for the house is now on an ankle monitor and can't go to work for the last 6 months. It's a real problem. Yeah, and they sucked his mother dry out of the bill. They're definitely sucking every dollar they can out of every bit of that family in order to win this case. Yeah, that's a definite thing that's going on for sure. I don't want to get into details, but I'm privy to a lot of it, and that's exactly what's happening. The state is sucking them all dry, and using different agencies against different parts of that family to create a situation where the mother can't take care of the kids. And so they can take the kids. You know, I mean, they're literally creating the problem here. The state is creating the problem here.
In this court case that you're doing, like, I can't help but wonder, like, I don't know, I was thinking about this the other day, because obviously this isn't so much the judge as compared to, like, the people that are, like, going against and doing the color of law here. But, like, is there any way that we can, like, start, like, holding, like, I know this is kind of what you're working on, but, like, can we start holding these people accountable, like, judges included? Because, like, I was having a conversation with somebody the other day, and it's like, you, like, because we were sitting there and we were talking about it, it's like, you know, these judges are making, these justices or whatever, they're making these decisions that are ruining families' lives, and then they go home on their, like, you know, golden throne fucking toilets and taking a shit on these golden throne toilets, and meanwhile they're not actually liable for actually anything at all. And I feel like if we would, like, and it's going to be hard, but start holding these people, like, actually liable and catching them in court, because I know that's exactly what you're kind of trying to do here, catching them in court and, like, making them personally liable for this stuff, that it's like, if more people start doing this, standing up and making these people, including the judges, personally liable, it's like, I feel like this kind of nonsense would turn around quickly. I mean, obviously the next step would be, like, you know, start doing things, like, that are not so civil, but, you know, I feel like this would be the better route before we start, you know, yanking people.
You know,
but
it's funny that you mentioned that, Sam, because one of the things that I did, and because I'm not a lawyer, so I don't give a shit. One of the things I did with this particular client was I threw out there the idea that these people who were lying on the CPS agents, right? They lied about we read that document I think a week or two ago on one of your shows. So we know that they sent that document to him directly at the residence he lived at, right?
Yeah, yep, yes.
Okay, and then we also went over the fact that they were making accusations that were absolutely incorrect and they were making threats, and they were doing all kinds of illegal activity based on, like, their own sworn, or not sworn, but signed documents. They signed it saying, hey, we're doing this, this, and this. And we were like, well, hold on. These people are acting under color of law because there's nothing in the law that permits these people in this agency to do these things. So they must be acting in their private capacity, right?
Mm-hmm.
That was our thing. But they sent him that notice from a government, using government paperwork. They sent that notice to his private residence, and all operating under in ways that they weren't allowed to use their office.
Mm-hmm.
So we were like, okay, so these people are using their public office to act in a private capacity. That's exactly what color of law is.
Yeah.
And what I did, and I, although I advised my client against it, I gave him the opportunity because here's what I did. I found out where those two, that husband and wife DSS worker, live, and they actually live the next county over, and I sent him a screenshot of their house and their address from the county records, and I said, hey, why not send them a notice to their own, a notice to rebut their shit, but send it to their private address? Because, okay.
And then send it registered mail so they have to accept it.
Well, hold on. The I don't care about all that. The reason I brought that up was because here's the situation. If you're going to act in your private capacity to send me mail at my address, like, you know where I live, right? Well, then maybe I should respond to it by sending mail to your private address and letting you know that I know where you live at.
Mm-hmm.
Because none of this is official. Like, the shit that you did, the crimes that you committed by using your government position to do this, doesn't mean that I can't respond to it at your address. Oh, and I know what your address is, and I know where your house is.
Yeah.
Now, the problem is when you do that they get scared and they call the cops, and the cops do everything they can to protect those people because they're quote-unquote public officials, okay? But the fact of the matter is, once they get that piece of mail and you don't make any threats, you just simply respond to their private communication to your private address with a private communication to their address, right?
Yeah.
So it's touchy because because they will pull a lot of crap out of their hats and hurt you.
They're already
if
doing
you do
it.
But exactly. That was my point. It's like, well, they're already doing it. Why not just do it back? And you didn't threaten them. You just told them, hey, you told them the same thing they told you. If you don't do what we tell you, we're going to use the law against you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, great. Well, if you don't do what I tell you, I'm going to use the law against you. Oh, and by the way, I'm sorry this particular piece of mail didn't go to your office address and accidentally showed up at your house. You fuck. Excuse my language.
Oh, it's all good.
But judges, all government agents, their shit can be tracked down. It's not hard. It's all public record.
Mm-hmm.
Anyone who owns a house, it's a public record. It's on the, it's on the county website.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway. I got a little off topic there. It's getting 20 minutes in, so I'm not gonna read much more of this, but I will get into section 2
with the letter that we went actually over on your show before.
Mm-hmm.
On or about July 19th, 2023, plaintiff received a written statement from the defendant Department of Social Services by way of certified mail. The written statement claims that the defendants have chosen to place the plaintiff's name upon a public record for the expressed purpose of causing the plaintiff injury in both his right to work and reputation. The written statement also evidences a form of extortion of the plaintiff in that it says that the defendant will, quote, delay the placement of the plaintiff's name upon the aforementioned list if the plaintiff waives his right to due process. The written statement contained the name of defendant Tondria Waddell and was signed by defendant Donovan Waddell and one other person whose name is currently unavailable and shall be deemed to be defendant Doe number one. The document contained the name and logo of defendant Department of Social Services at the very top portion of the paper. The written statement claims that an investigatory assessment was performed and that a decision was made to substantiate, based upon testimony of the child, child medical exam, and evidence from law enforcement investigations. The person who made that decision shall be deemed to be defendant Doe number two. First and foremost, considering the fact that defendants should have previously been aware that both law enforcement reports that have previously been aware through both law enforcement reports and available public records of pending court cases that there was never any allegation made against the plaintiff of any sexual or other abuse of either the plaintiffs or any other child, the plaintiff declares that the investigative assessment was without legal purpose or foundation. Now, the reason we had to put that in there is because under North Carolina statutes, it has to be a criminal act without legal purpose in order to get the restraining order. So we informed them that this was without legal purpose and how. Secondly, the defendants have stated that its decision was based first upon testimony of the child. Okay. Plaintiff has provided this court with evidence labeled Exhibit A and Exhibit B, and I'm not going to get into what those were, that the testimony of the child clearly indicate that the child explicitly denies any allegations of inappropriate or unlawful acts committed by the plaintiff, which might have given rise to an investigative assessment having any legal purpose. Defendants have not produced a single item of evidence to support their statement. Third, the defendants stated that their decision was based secondly upon a child medical exam. Plaintiff has provided this court with evidence labeled Exhibit A and Exhibit C in the form of statements that no medical exam of the child was ever performed. Defendants have not produced a single item of evidence to support their statement. Plaintiff would be elated to simply have the name of the doctor who allegedly examined the child, and if this court deems it necessary to require the parties to engage in the discovery process, instead of immediately granting the no-contact order, the plaintiff is more than willing to engage in that procedure. In other words, they said, well, we have evidence from a child medical exam. Okay, great. Well, we don't care about what the results of it were. We just want to know who the doctor that performed it was. Like, really, give us the name of the doctor so we can call him to the stand. They can't give you the name of a doctor that didn't perform an exam, and then no exam happened. So that we mm-hmm. just asked for the name of the doctor. Like, we're not saying, yeah. You know, we don't care what the doctor said, you know. We just want to know who the doctor was.
Yeah.
Right? All right. Fair enough. All right. Mm-hmm. Fourth, the defendants have stated that this decision was thirdly based upon, quote, evidence from law enforcement investigations. Okay. Well, the plaintiff has access to evidence from law enforcement investigations in the form of police reports, DA investigations, and other public records that completely contradict the defendant's statements. Should the defendants lack any verifiable facts to prove their written statement, then it must be deemed false. And a false written statement made by anyone acting under color of law for the expressed intended purpose of violating rights, extortion, or causing injury cannot have any quote-unquote legal purpose. The fact is that the plaintiff has already filed two separate criminal complaints against the defendant and has provided evidence of their violations of law. See Exhibit D in reference to General Statute 14-118, Exhibit D in reference to General Statute 14-277.1, Exhibit E in reference to North Carolina General Statute 14-226, and Exhibit D, we gave them all the statutes that we provided evidence for.
Mm-hmm.
And we have evidence, so we gave it to them. I mean, why not just bring it to the court right off the bat, right? Here you go.
Yeah.
Here's what it is. This is what we mean by what we say, because we don't have anything to hide. We're bringing it all to the front, right on the bat, with our claim.
Mm-hmm.
In summary, the plaintiff declares that the defendants engaged in criminal acts of extortion, subordination, of perjury, menacing, fraud, and false claims without lawful purpose. And then we went into the whole thing about how each of our exhibits relates to the evidence laws and why it's admissible. And then we went into the summary. Defendants have engaged in criminal acts without lawful purpose on multiple occasions and in multiple forms, which place the plaintiff and his family at extensive risk of harm or injury. Defendants have acted well outside the scope and authorities of their positions of employment and present a clear and present danger to not only the plaintiff, but the residents of Randolph County as well, should they be permitted to continue such acts without liability. This is one of the things that a lot of people forget to include in their shit, is, look, yeah, this happened as a result of your situation. However,
yeah,
if it's allowed to continue, it's going to create a public problem, because
mm-hmm.
people need to remember to put in their complaints why the acts of the defendant create a public issue. Because when you put it in there, how it affects the public negatively, that's where you get your relief.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this is happening to me, but if it were to literally happen to anybody else in this county, then that's a problem, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's a public issue. All right.
Yeah.
Requested relief. Plaintiff hereby requires an order of this honorable court to cause the defendants to immediately and permanently cease and desist from all contact with the plaintiff, his child, his extended family, to include the mother and the minor stepdaughter. Plaintiff requests that such an order include that the defendants are to permanently refrain from visiting, calling, mailing, or otherwise harassing or communicating with any of the above-mentioned parties in any way whatsoever. Plaintiff further requests that the order include that the defendants are to be prohibited from placing the plaintiff's name on any publicly available list, including but not limited to their responsible individual list, which may cause damage to the plaintiff's reputation, and to provide reasonable compensation and or attorney's fees to the plaintiff in this instant matter. Plaintiff further requests that the order include that the defendant must provide all available documents in their possession related to their quote-unquote investigative assessment and include any documents, including the mother's signature or any other public records held in their possession or referred to in their statements, such as law enforcement investigation reports, police reports, the names and contact information for any licensed medical professional involved in the alleged quote-unquote child medical exam, which may be used to provide any evidence in any pending or future court cases involving the plaintiff to the plaintiff agent, and put the name and number there. Plaintiff further requests that the order include that the defendants Chandria Wydell and Donovan Wydell be immediately removed from any official employment for the safety and of the residents of Randolph County and any other relief this honorable court may find appropriate. So I made it with 8 minutes to spare.
Well, we're not doing commercials today because I'm not inside at the computer. I'm outside in the garden. So if you want to keep going, you're good to go.
Okay, well, I'll use the last 8 minutes to tell you what happened when we filed this. The original case, the criminal case for the felony peeping, it's got a whole lot of its own issues. But the next hearing is on August 14th. We filed this today, and the hearing for this is on August 10th. And basically what we told the court was, hey, if you want to delay this hearing to provide an opportunity for the defendants to deal with a discovery thing, we'd be more than happy to do with that. Because, I mean, honestly, if they give us an opportunity for discovery in this civil case, that'd be great. Because then we can use all the discovery that we get in this civil case, in the criminal case.
Hmm.
It's called strategy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we're filing a civil complaint against you to keep you away from us, and this is why. And anything that comes about from this civil restraining order case can and ends up in the record can be used for the criminal case as a defense. Because then we could prove that the plaintiff was witness tampering and all kinds of other shit.
So this is kind of like, if you want to do that, that's fine, but you're going to hang yourself if you do.
Yeah, because we're not, this isn't criminal. This is just civil. All we're asking is for you to leave us alone. And if you don't want to leave us alone, then you have to explain why you shouldn't leave us alone, which opens yourself up to discovery, which we can use as the plaintiff's claim, right? The plaintiff's record, the plaintiff in the criminal case is the state. Well, the defendant in the civil case is the state. So go ahead and file, ask for a discovery. We would love that.
Mm-hmm.
Because anything we discover in this civil case can be used as a defense in the criminal case.
Mm.
It's, yeah, I don't know if you guys have seen Breaking Bad, but all I'm going to say is discovery, bitches. Like, you know what I mean? Like,
this reminds me of that Spider-Man meme where they're all just pointing at each other, like the three Spider-Mans are pointing at each other. That's what this reminds me of right now.
Oh, that is constant in my life. Like, I got this case out of North Carolina where we've literally got the state of North Carolina, the state of Georgia, and the state of Pennsylvania, and the Secretary of State of California, all in and attorney generals and secretaries of state, all in argument with each other. And we can prove that they're in argument with each other. So it's really like, hey, as long as they're arguing among themselves, they won't be bothering us.
Yep.
Go ahead, argue. In the meantime, I'm going to keep doing what I'm doing, because if you guys are arguing about this, then obviously you can't agree. And if nobody can agree, then I shouldn't be held responsible.
Yep.
That's exactly the point. Yeah, I like the way you put it. Well, that's pretty much all I had to say. I just wanted to throw that out there, what we were doing. Our civil case is being heard 4 days before the next hearing on the criminal case, which hasn't even been arraigned yet after 6 months. So, I mean, sometimes you just got to go on the freaking offense. And you do that in a different court with a different judge in a whole different ballgame. Because this restraining order is a civil case. It's a civil case. They follow different rules. But anything we get out of this civil case can be used in the criminal case.
Yeah.
If you find a way to go after them, get it. Because, and if you can get it in front of a different court and a different judge, all you need is a little bit of differentiation. You don't need a whole lot, just a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can do that, if you can drag that out through a civil case, freaking do it, man. Just do it. If you find any reason to file a civil case against anybody filing a criminal case against you, this stuff... It definitely disrupts the system. I can't tell you if it works yet. I won't know until, you know, after the 14th, to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
But in 6 days, I'll know how the civil case turned out. I won't be able to tell you how that affected the criminal case for 4 days after that. But I can tell you that it will. It will definitely affect the criminal case. My client wanted, he filed a cease and desist letter. Yesterday, against social services, and I told him, I said, man, why did you waste your time putting that together? And he goes, well, I felt like I had to do it. I said, well, look, dude, it's good that you had that feeling, and it's good that you did it. But the fact of the matter is, filing a cease and desist letter in private isn't going to make any difference. If you really want to screw these people, put them back in court.
Oh, yeah.
Because a cease and desist letter is, they can ignore it, and then you got to go through all that. Nah, just get at them as soon as you can. As soon as you find a cause of action, go for it.
Mm-hmm.
Go for it. You might lose. Chances are pretty good you're going to lose. But at least it'll be on the record that you tried.
Yeah.
And, I mean, do I expect that these people are going to, that CPS is going to go into that hearing on the 10th and go, well, we want discovery so we can defend ourselves? Really? Highly unlikely that they'll do that, but if they do, good for us.
Yeah,
we want discovery too. Because we have original wedding signatures on documents stating that you're making claims that are absolutely unprovable on behalf of your client, which is the plaintiff in another case. So let's go. Yeah, sure, we're good. Yeah, yeah, we're down for discovery. Did you or did you not do this? Did you or did you not do that? Come on now. Go ahead. Yeah, we would love discovery in this civil case. They won't do it. They won't do it. And if they won't do it, I guarantee you we're going to get the restraining order. And at the very least, without any admission of guilt from the plaintiff, we can use that restraining order in the criminal case as evidence that they were witness tampering.
Yeah.
There's no loss in this situation at all. It doesn't matter whether they give us the restraining order or not. Fact of the matter is, somebody's going to have to prove something right now, and it has to be done before the criminal case is next hearing.
Mm-hmm.
Good. So, that's called strategy.
Nice. Rod, do you have any comments on this?
I was just about to ask that. I would love to hear from Rod.
Yeah. Well, where I am, there's a crime called coercion. And I'm looking in North Carolina statutes under coercion, and all I find is about debt collectors are not supposed to use coercion. There might be an old common law crime, coercion. It's
okay.
You know, forcing someone to do something.
Let me stop you right there. Isn't the state trying to collect a debt?
Okay.
That was a yes or no question.
Well,
I mean,
that way that these
aren't they trying to put this? Aren't they trying to make this man serve them in their jail? It provide his time and energy and life force. Are they trying to collect a debt?
Right.
That they allege is owed?
Okay.
I mean, let's give it the benefit of the doubt. Let's say they just are trying to collect the debt. Well then.
All right. Well, then you could file a criminal complaint, I suppose. I don't know a lot about filing criminal complaints, except you put the facts down, put it under oath, and put it in front of a judge, and let them figure out what to do about it.
I can't even. It's a long story. We've already filed at least 2 criminal complaints against this defendant. With the sheriff. We've been on the phone with the sheriff for 45 minutes. They clearly said they weren't going to investigate it, even though we sent them evidence of the existing crime.
Yeah. Cops like to say they're a middleman. You have to go through them, not around them. But
I'm just telling you about this case.
Right. I don't know about how much legal foundation it is. It has. If I were you, I would simply do what I said, just put the facts in an affidavit and go in ex parte. Or really, that's E-X-P-A-R-T-E.
Yeah, yeah. No, we've already filed all of those criminal complaints.
Maybe our listeners do not.
We filed those into the court already, and with the district attorney, and with the court-appointed public defender, and the sheriff. And now we're working with the State Bureau of Investigation because the sheriff sent us there when they said they wouldn't investigate the crimes that we provided them evidence of. So now we're going to...
Yeah, I was just kind of quickly explaining just for, like, in case, because there are listeners who are, like, completely, like, bleh. So you were just doing a quickie explain for anybody listening, and they're just kind of, yeah.
Right, yeah. Yeah, there is a procedure for that, and Rod's right. Yeah, you have to do the things you do. But in this particular case, we've run into an exceptional circumstance where none of our public servants are doing anything but protecting each other. But yes, Rod's right. There is a procedure for that, and you should do it. It's, there's a reason it's there. There's a purpose for it. So absolutely do that. Yeah.
Let's explain that procedure just, like, super quick. Do you mind just explaining that really quick for us, Rod?
Well, you go to your courthouse, or you, in the modern world, you check on their webpage and find out when the scheduled ex parte days and times are. And there's a particular judge in a particular room, particular days and times. And so you just go and you stand in line with mostly attorneys. And then when it gets to your turn, you get to talk to the judge, and whatever you want to say, you say. There are certain kinds of matters that are supposed to be ex parte, and if you bring in something else that isn't that, well, the judge will figure out what to do with it.
Okay.
So you can get some kind of answer right away.
Okay. Yeah, and this is the stuff that Pixie has already filed with the courts. He's filed with all the things, and like you mentioned, everybody's just kind of working with cahoots, and they don't really want to kind of actually deal with it.
Well, you know, the good thing about that is the only good thing about that is that you tend to develop evidence. If done properly, you develop evidence. Because when you have somebody that's supposed to investigate a crime or do something about it, clearly telling you, yeah, we don't really give two shits about that, then, you know, you move further up the food chain. And
can you, like, get
eventually...
that in writing? Because I've heard, like, you know, just, like, from you saying this, that the cops are like, nah, we don't want to file that. And, like, I'm a sucker for Judge Judy. And, like, so many times I hear, like, these defendants or plaintiffs or whatever, they're like, oh, we went to go file a police report and the police didn't want to do it. Or, oh, we tried to file this and the police didn't want to do it. Like, is there, like, a way you can ever, like, get that in writing? Or they just, like, refuse to put it in writing or, like, get it in recording or something?
Yeah,
like,
Listen, you email them at their publicly available web address, email, and you call them on their publicly available phone, because there's always a record of that. The public dollars pay for that phone number, and public dollars pay for that email address. So anything that goes to that phone number, even the metadata, say your phone called that number on such and such a time and such a date, whatever. That's not a lot, but it is something. Okay, but public money pays for those web addresses too, and those email addresses. And when you send something to their email address, especially a publicly paid for email address, it becomes a public record. It's very easy to track. You can literally add every piece of evidence, like the date, time, email address, the text, everything. You can send all of that into the court as evidence, because that is evidence. If it's a web address that's paid for by the public, then you can use it as evidence. I sent these people this. I sent the sheriff's department this criminal complaint against this government agency on such and such a time and such date. I presented all this evidence through PDF format. You could testify to all that, but you could also write it down so you don't even have to testify. But absolutely.
Noted.
Anytime you do that, it's a publicly available record, and they cannot reject it they can reject it, but they can't deny that they have obtained it. So if they say, yeah, we rejected that as irrelevant, then you can bring up all the shit that you put in there, including your evidence, and going, why is this much evidence irrelevant to the sheriff's department?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you call these fuckers on their shit all day long. Yeah, you just got to know how to do it.
Good to know. Okay, Rod, back to you for your more of your comments. Yeah. What else did you want to say there?
Another avenue that occurs to me is citizen's arrest. If something, particularly a felony, occurs in your presence, then of course, you got to follow the statutes, but... And you say you're under arrest, and I know a fellow who arrested an off-duty cop, and he said that they are trained. They're training. If anyone, because this is not a new idea, if anyone says you're under arrest, they're trained to stop moving, and then you have a duty to take them. What I've read is, in order to legally complete the arrest, you're supposed to put your hand on their shoulder or get them to agree to submit to your authority as the arresting person. So just ask, I need to legally complete the arrest. Do you want to submit to my authority, or do I have to place my hand on your shoulder? And then you have a duty to take them to the magistrate, and you could just say, okay, meet me at the courthouse at 9 o'clock tomorrow morning. And if they blow that off, then maybe you can get them fired.
It's terrible that I'm listening to you and I'm agreeing with you, but I will tell you, personally, my actions would not be so benevolent. If I had to do something, I would do it, and I wouldn't wait till 9 o'clock tomorrow. The main thing I disagree with you on is waiting until 9 o'clock tomorrow. We're going now. Now. I'm going now. Because there's, I'm making a claim. And I need my claim fucking looked at right now. Because if I'm wrong, I need to apologize to that person immediately and make restitution. So I probably wouldn't be wrong. I would never do something like that and be wrong. But if I were, I would definitely want an immediate out from a neutral third party. So that's the first thing. The second thing I would say is, this is a hard thing to say without getting in trouble, but putting your hand on somebody's shoulder does not... I might go a little further than that, is all I'm going to say.
If I felt that
was necessary, I would probably feel that a little bit more was necessary as well.
Yeah. Well, I've read that that's a requirement to legally complete the arrest. It doesn't say anything about it in the statutes. So,
oh, wow. I don't care about the statutes.
Okay. Well.
But I understand what you're saying, and it does make sense. It does make sense. I mean, literally the last thing you ever want to do is put your hands on somebody. I mean, in this whole concept of an argumentative society that we kind of tend to live in these days, I don't agree with that. And I think you're right. The last thing you want to do is literally put your hands on somebody. I really believe that. But that doesn't mean I wouldn't.
In case it's a legal requirement, or if you're in court and you want to arrest the judge, you say the same thing. Okay, bailiff, please take my hand and place it on this man's shoulder. Just a legal, just a step. And I would expect
right,
that's not a way of saying it. And another thing is, it doesn't have to be out on the street with no witnesses when there's a problem. But it could be that you call up their boss and you say, I want a meeting with this employee, and you about 1 o'clock tomorrow afternoon or whatever, you're going for a meeting, and then you can arrest
their
boss. Yeah.
Right.
But they're not likely to try to beat you or whatever in front of the boss.
Well, that would be generally acceptable and the most beneficial thing to do. I'm just saying, if you had to put your hands on somebody, the first thing I would do if I had to put my hands on somebody is go get a neutral third party to agree that that was necessary.
Well, as a matter of law, that could be hard to find out. There might be,
because I didn't want to touch that person. I didn't want to touch that person. Never. But if I didn't, this really terrible shit would have happened, So sometimes you got to explain to somebody why you put your hands on somebody. But
the first thing I would want to do is
explain to them that I didn't want to.
I thought I made that clear. The first thing is you say, you say, in order to legally complete the arrest, one of two things has to happen. Either you need to submit to my authority as the arresting person, or I need to place my hand on your shoulder. Which one do you want to do?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, I think we're in the same frame of mind with that one.
There was once I knew somebody whose relative was an IRS employee, and I talked to him, and he said in Ireland, the tax collector cannot legally assess or collect a tax until they physically put their hands on you. Again,
oh yeah, that's true. I've been to Ireland a couple times. I have family over there, and I'm well familiar with the legal situation there, and when it comes to private property, yeah, and that is true, actually. Yes.
Those are two examples of where something where a hand on the shoulder is legally required.
Well, Sam. I appreciate you letting me be on the show and showing what we did out there. Rod, I'm going to tell you the same thing I always tell you. I appreciate you. I respect you. I love you. I adore you. And I still have no idea how to get in touch with you because I am very good at not keeping a digital trail. And that means that I forget a lot of shit, but I mean, I don't forget people or what I need or why I appreciate them.
Right.
But
well, that
I definitely cannot get, I still cannot get in touch with you. And hopefully someday we will soon. It's my fault, not yours.
Notebook.
Say again?
You could keep a notebook, although, of course, it might be found. You could keep it in code. You could work on your memory.
Again, I am doing what I can toward that end. Hopefully, very soon, we will be able to touch base on a more frequent basis. Like, Sam can touch base with me, but for some reason, there's something keeping us apart, and it's probably me, but I appreciate you. Adore you. Thank you so much, Sam, for letting me be on the show. I'm gonna get going. I've got a couple of things to do tonight before I go to bed, so thanks for keeping up the hard work and letting this show be on the air.
No problem. Thank you for showing up.
I love
up.
You, Rod. I love you, Sam. I'll talk
love
to you guys
you,
later. Bye.
Bye. Alrighty. So I'm still watering my garden. We will not be doing any commercial breaks today. I am currently watering my beans. I got the broccoli and the cauliflower, the Brussels sprouts, the cabbage, and all those things done. So now it's bean time. And I got to do carrots and beets and a couple other things, and then I'll be done for that. What time is it even? I don't even know what time it is. It is 8:20. Holy smokes. Yes, I have a very large garden. Rod, are you still there? Oh, did Rod leave? Oh, you're still there? I thought I heard you, but I wasn't sure. Oh, yeah, you're still there. Rod, say something. I just hear key clicking. Can you hear me? Not sure what's going on there, but it is what it is. So, trying to think of something that I could talk about. Not going to lie. Just give me a minute. I'll rant about something here.
I will hang up and call back.
I'm not inside.
Maybe I should hang up and call back and get a better connection.
No, you're good now. I can hear you now. You're good.
I'm good. All
right. You're good now. Before I was just a little into little clicks and stuff, but if you hang up, then I'm going to have to unhook everything, go inside, and then let you on, and then come back outside. So you're good now.
All right.
Perfect. So how you been?
Oh, well enough.
Good, good. Been a little busy over here. Going to have some folks over this week to help me get this wall of peony done. I'm currently working, for anybody that doesn't know, I'm currently working on an underground greenhouse in order to be able to grow food year-round. Probably won't have it done enough that I can grow because I live in Saskatchewan. Therefore, it gets to be like, you know, minus 40 and stuff in February for a week straight. So I don't think I'll have the rocket stove and everything done enough to be able to grow in the middle of the dead of winter. However, that will absolutely be a finished project next year. This year, I'm just working on building the cob insulation, straw bale insulation with cob around it, and that is a mixture straw and sand and clay. It's kind of like a natural cement that you can utilize that is free or at the very least very, very cheap. To build yourself what is a very fire-resistant, very warm, and very eco-friendly building to keep you nice and toasty, warm, and out of the freezing rain or the pouring rain and the freezing cold and the blistering heat because it stays nice and cool. But I'm also kind of making it as a combination as a passive solar greenhouse and not just a wall of peony. That's what it's called, is wall of peony, W-A-L. Walla, W-A-L-A-P-I-N-I. So if you guys want to check that out, I would also encourage you to go over to websites like permies.com, P-E-R-M-I-E-S, and check out that website. Their forum is absolutely excellent. And then I would also highly recommend Matthew Steffens and Permaculture Gaia, whatever it is, Permaculture Gaia. You can find his group on Facebook. Permies is free. Permaculture Gaia is $15 for membership for a year, and then you get access to the website, the chat rooms, and all that other stuff. That guy studied with Bill Mollison, the kind of grandfather of permaculture. It's kind of funny to classify him as the grandfather of permaculture, considering humans have been doing, working with nature, agriculture for millennia. That, you know, this one man just kind of came in and fixed all the problems. And all he really did was take a look around and was just like, okay, what we're doing isn't working, so how do we fix it? And then got a lot of knowledge from either just common sense stuff or talking to, you know, researching and talking to people who do things the way things should be done, essentially. Not so much the way they are, but the way things should be done. And trying to educate and bring things back. I've been looking into things like agroecology lately, working with the land. It's not quite as effective as permaculture. Permaculture is a lot more nature-based than agroecology, but agroecology, I feel, is a step in the right direction as compared to agriculture. Looking more into, you know, how we can keep growing our crops to feed the world, but doing it in a more nature-friendly manner, because the way we've been doing things hasn't been working. And I've vented about that before on the show this winter when I've actually got time, and I'm not in the middle of watering a freaking garden in the middle of my radio show. I will sit down and actually do some formal presentations, and I'm hoping by then we'll actually be able to have video options for freedomists, as well. So we'll have to, I'll keep you guys updated on that, because we've got new shows coming, we've got new changes coming, and things are exciting. So yeah, other than that, what do you have for us today, Rod? Let's go for it. Let's see what you got, because I could sit here and talk about green beans all day long, but let's see what you got.
Well, there's another therapist named Bessel van der Kolk who studies trauma, and he wrote a book called The Body Keeps the Score.
I love that book. So we're going back to the addiction and stuff, right? Where we cut off before? Perfect. Okay, continue.
Trauma, anyway, yeah. So, right, he says, traumatized people chronically feel unsafe inside their bodies. The past is alive in the form of an annoying interior discomfort, constantly bombarded by visceral warning signs. And in an attempt to control these processes, they often become expert at ignoring their gut feelings and numbing awareness to what is played out inside. They learn to hide from themselves. And the single most important issue for traumatized people is to find a sense of safety in their own bodies.
Mm-hmm.
And that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that book. I actually, funny enough, actually when not today, but speaking about trauma, there's a book that I just found at the library. So I'm going to have to sit down. Like, I'm going to be working on this world. We're butchering chickens tomorrow, just a little bit, whatever. We're butchering chickens tomorrow. And then I'm going to be working on this wall of painting over the next couple of weeks. And then I'm going to be on a combine starting kind of end of August till kind of middle of October. And then if there's a rainy day or a day where I'm not combining or something, I'm going to hit you up, Rob, because I found a book, The Body Keeps Score. I think it was that book that the very first chapter they were talking about veterans and PTSD. Was it that one? I think it was that one.
Sounds
pretty
right.
Sure it was that one. But I found a book about a veteran talking about his PTSD, and I think it's really interesting, and I want to sit down with you, and I want to read that one with you when I have some time.
Yeah. And so we've
anyway,
all been
continue.
Traumatized. Right. We've all been traumatized to some extent, and I, this is the source of the blockers that Stuart Lichtman talks about in the cybernetic transposition success narrative. Whenever you want to improve your life, something in you comes and stops you because it doesn't feel safe. And that's related to early traumas. So we need to communicate with the unconscious to and negotiate and resolve this thing, but what I want to do is it really is okay. As they say, getting out of your own way. And he says that they did a study on yoga for people with PTSD, and they found that
mm-hmm.
yoga was more effective than any medicine that people have studied up to now.
Hmm. What kind of yoga?
Say.
Hmm. Keep going.
He says you need to become safe to feel what you feel.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking about in my guided meditation spirit, I can explore different emotions. You know, let's feel this one and let's feel that one. I'm a little hesitant to launch into that. So he's all in favor of body-based techniques and learning to befriend your experience. And you continue, in PTSD, the body continues to defend against the threat that belongs to the past. And this other fellow, this group of Mate, also talks about the past intruding on the present. In the realm of hungry ghosts, close encounters with addiction. He says it is impossible, this is Gabor Mate now, it is impossible to understand addiction without asking what relief the addict finds or hopes to find in the drug or addictive behavior. And the greatest damage done by neglect, trauma, or emotional loss is not the immediate pain they inflict, the long-term distortions they induce in the way a developing child will continue to interpret the world and the situation. So we'll have self-fulfilling prophecies. We create meanings from our unconscious interpretations of early events, and then we forge our present experiences from the meaning we created. Unwittingly, we write the story of our future from narratives based on the past. Mindful awareness can bring into consciousness these hidden past-based perspectives so they no longer frame our worldview. Choice begins the moment you disidentify from the mind and its conditioned patterns, the moment you become present. Until you reach that point, you're unconscious. In present awareness, we are liberated from the past. So he's really in favor of mindfulness of the body in the present moment.
Hmm.
He says the difference between passion and addiction is that is the difference between a divine spark and a flame that incinerates. He says the attempt to escape from pain is what creates more pain. Understand not why the addiction, but why the pain.
Mm-hmm.
And here's something really intriguing. A therapist once said to me, if you face the choice between feeling guilt and resentment, choose the guilt every time. It is wisdom I have passed on to many others since. If a refusal saddles you with guilt, while consent leaves resentment in its wake, opt for the guilt. Resentment is soul suicide. Negative thinking allows us to gaze unflinchingly on our own behalf at what does not work. We have seen in study after study that compulsive thinkers are more likely to develop disease and less likely to survive. Genuine positive thinking, or more deeply positive being, empowers us to know that we have nothing to fear from truth. Health is not just a matter of thinking happy thoughts, writes the molecular researcher Candace Peart. Sometimes the biggest impetus to healing can come from jump-starting the immune system with a burst of long-suppressed anger. Anger, or this healthy experience of it, is one of the seven A's of healing. Each of the seven A's address one of the embedded visceral beliefs. Predisposed to illness and undermine healing when the body says no, the cost of hidden stress.
That one I haven't heard of.
Being cut off from our own natural self-compassion is one of the greatest impairments we can suffer. Along with our ability to feel our own pain, go our best hopes for healing, dignity, and love. What seems not adaptive and self-harming in the present was our what seems non-adaptive and self-harming in the present was, at some point in our lives, an adaptation to help us endure what we then had to go through. If people are addicted to self-soothing behaviors, it's only because in their formative years they did not receive the soothing they needed. Such understanding helps delete toxic self-judgment on the past and supports responsibility for the now, hence the need for compassionate self-inquiry. You know, Jesus said, love others as you love yourself. He never said, love yourself. That seems to have been assumed. Now, I don't know whether the ancient Israelis or ancient Israelites had more self-compassion than we do now, because it's a completely different society.
Mm-hmm.
And we may need to be told, love yourself. He says, at the core of every addiction is an emptiness based in abject fear. Dreads and abhors the present moment. She bends feverishly only towards the next time, the moment when her brain, infused with her drug of choice, will briefly experience itself as liberated from the burden of the past and the fear of the future, the two elements that make the present intolerable. Many of us resemble the drug addict in our ineffectual efforts to fill in the spiritual black hole, the void at the center, where we have lost touch with our souls, our spirit, with those sources of meaning and value that are not contingent or fleeting. Our consumerist, acquisition, action, and image-mad culture only serves to deepen the hole, leaving us emptier than before. The constant, intrusive, and meaningless mind world that characterizes the way so many of us experience our silent moments is in itself a form of addiction, and it serves the same purpose. One of the main tasks of the mind is to fight or remove the emotional pain, which is one of the reasons for its incessant activity. But all it can ever achieve is to cover it up temporarily. In fact, the harder the mind struggles to get rid of the pain, the greater the pain, so writes Eckhart Tolle. Even our 24/7 self-exposure to noise, emails, cell phone, TV, internet chats, media outlets, music downloads, video games, and nonstop internal and external chatter cannot succeed in drowning out the fearful voices within. That's some pretty heavy stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Boredom. Did you want to answer that?
Okay. No, keep going.
He says, boredom, rooted in a fundamental discomfort with the self, is one of the least tolerable mental states. Now, most people don't like being alone, and because of they don't like their thoughts. Well, I seem to have gotten over that a long time ago. I don't mind being alone, and and I don't get bored. Maybe it's just I'm not a kid anymore, and your kid, you get bored a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But he says that boredom is rooted in a fundamental discomfort with self. So it's time to do some shadow work, I guess. We see that substance addictions are only one specific form of blind attachment to harmful ways of being, yet we condemn the addict's stubborn refusal to give up something deleterious to his life or to the life of others. Why do we despise, ostracize, and punish the drug addict when, as a social collective, we share the same blindness and engage in the same rationalizations?
Mm.
Well, we could ask, who's the we? It might be the entire English-speaking world, or it might be all of the West, or it might be, you know, Japan. I don't know how they view drug addicts. Probably Native Americans did not have a category called drug addict. Of course, I guess you have to have refined drugs before you could have drug addicts. But without that, you could have coca leaf chewers, you could have, you know, ganja smokers. I wouldn't have.
Yeah.
But it could be worth looking at, when did we begin despising, ostracizing, and punishing drug addicts? It might have been after the war. Much of our society got the way it is after the war. Particularly the rise of advertising and then just the consumerist thing. It just changed a lot. There's a fellow that writes about suburbs, and he said that the concept of a suburb came from the military, like a military base. And I didn't catch a lot of that, but it's an interesting idea. He says, this is Gabor Mate again, I needed to write to express myself through written language, not only so that others might hear me, but so that I could hear myself. And this is connected to the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis. Sapir and Whorf were two linguists who said that we can only think in language. Without language, we cannot think. And that's an academic point of view, because in academia, you're supposed to write papers, otherwise you're not doing anything. If you ask an artist, can you think in color? So I'm sure they can. You know, if you ask a sculptor, can you think in shapes? So he's got his narrow, they have this narrow idea of what thinking is, but certainly there's a lot of, once you learn to use language, then you can learn different, you know, a more extended kind of thought. But if you can't use language, so he can organize. You can organize your thoughts. So when you keep, you know, people who recommend journaling because of this, you take what's a half coherent thought and make it into a complete thought. I saw an advertisement for an app that helps you. It's supposed to help you organize your thoughts. And they show a big tangle. It's just a line drawing. It's just a big tangle, and then the second one is all a big spiral. So it says you organize your thoughts from being a tangle to a spiral by writing them down. App. And I think they use voice recording also.
Okay.
So you have the idea during the middle of the day, you're just talking to your phone, and the thing catches it and puts it into the.
What's this app called?
I'm not doing any advertising.
What'd you say?
And. They also use AI. They said they use AI to help with it.
Yeah, I was going to ask if that's like some sort of AI app or something. Well, what's this app called again?
Oh.
If you don't know, that's fine.
Yeah. It might be Mindly. Organize your inner
Mindly.
Universe. Yeah.
Keep going.
Right. So my starting point for all of these interests in addiction and so forth is the cybernetic predisposition and the need to communicate with your unconscious to resolve blockers that prevent your success. So this fellow says, no society can understand itself without looking at its shadow side. And so there we have Carl Jung's shadow side of shadow work, but he's extending it to the entire society, not just the individual. Once you learn about psychology for yourself, then you can ask, well, what about other people are going through this same thing, and how can I deal with them better because I know they're going through this? He says the research literature, so now he's extending it to society as a whole, the research literature has identified three factors that universally lead to stress: uncertainty, lack of information, and the loss of control. There's some condensed wisdom. He says that all the diagnoses you deal with, depression, anxiety, ADHD, bipolar illness, post-traumatic PTSD, even psychosis, are significantly rooted in trauma. They're manifestations of trauma. Therefore, the diagnoses don't explain anything. The problem in the medical world is that we diagnose somebody and we think that's the explanation. He's behaving that way because he's psychotic. She's behaving that way because she has ADHD. Nobody has ADHD. Nobody has psychosis. These are processes within the individual. It's not a thing that you have. This is a process that expresses your life experience. It has meaning in every single case.
You know, that's really interesting, especially with, like, the rise of TikTok and, like, you know, the rise of people that are, like, claiming, because, like, I've said that, like, quite a few times, I will never get an official diagnosis, like, never, ever, ever, because I don't want to be on the record. I don't want to be on the radar. But, like, I know damn well that, like, my brain thinks in, like, ADHD modes. And having learned, like, the processes of ADHD and, like, how, like, my brain operates, it's, like, I've learned the efficient tools on, like, you know, how to function properly or, like, get back to, I mean, not necessarily, like, get back to what is considered normal, but, like, like, kind of undo the things that are in the brain that are not working effectively, like harnessing the things that it's like, okay, this is something that I can utilize for, like, you know, like furthering myself or my knowledge or things like that. But then, like, kind of like, okay, well, this isn't really helping me. How can I undo this? But, like, you know, it's like I've quite often said that, like, I have ADHD, so it's just kind of funny that you're like, oh, you don't have that. It's a process. It's like, well, you know, it's interesting that you bring that up. Synchronicities, I guess.
I knew a fellow who made a tester. I mean, it was some kind of software thing. You look at the screen and I'm not sure what, but it tests whether you have ADHD, some kind of reaction thing. He says a lot of people think they have it, but if they haven't tested, then they don't have it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree with you about not getting, being very wary about, particularly kids, getting labeled, because then they get special help.
Yeah.
And, oh, we've got a budget for that, but we got to categorize you. We got to put you in a separate room and all that. And all the crazy people, you know, all the other kids that they've labeled.
Yeah. Which is exactly why that it's like, I will never go get an official diagnosis. I know for sure, just like, having spoken to people who are diagnosed and looking at my own habits that, like, oh, I didn't know that was actually, like, a thing. And it's like, oh, okay, maybe I am weird. You know, it's like I don't really, like, you know, walking along and, like, you know, talking to myself or, like, daydreaming or, like, multitasking all over the place, not being able to start something, you know, like, things like that. It's just like, oh, okay, I got you. But it's just like, no, the diagnosis labels, that's the state likes it's like, you know, the state likes to use these things as a means of taking control and milking you and that kind of thing, just like we spent, like, the first, like, hour and a half talking about with Pixie problems rather than actually help you. And if you don't utilize their help, they're going to break your knees and then offer you a wheelchair kind of thing. So I definitely agree that it's just like, no, it's a real shame that it's just like, man, if I go and take the cookie from the state, it's going to be a poison cookie, but at least it's going to taste good, I guess, you know?
All right.
Continue.
All right. the teachers say there are plenty of opportunities in special ed. Well, special ed is the kids who are labeled weird and stupid. And, you know, it's just a, you know, my mom told me that when I was very small, one of the teachers wanted me to see the school psychologist because during recess, I would sit by myself at the sound box. The other kids were all, and my dad said, over my dead body, and said, that kid's healthier than the psychologist. Because what he does is he sits there and he designs a sandcastle in his mind and then he makes it. Whereas these other kids, they're just making a pile, and the other kid knocks the pile down. The other kid makes a pile, the first kid knocks that pile down. And they're just making a mess of each other's thing. They're not doing it in their minds at all. And here's this kid designing and building his little sandcastle. So he thought there's nothing wrong with that at all. So that was, over by a dead body. That was just interesting.
Hmm.
Interesting thing. Yeah, so I didn't get labeled. But yes, you mentioned TikTok. I remember somebody listing all the symptoms of something like ADHD or something. Self-soothing, tapping the fingers and patterns and even walking on tiptoes. And I did this thing. Yeah. And also there are enough mental illnesses listed in the DHM. What is it called? There's a manual for psychiatrists on how to categorize everybody. And is that every one of them will fit somebody. And often you can make several of them fit. It's just depending what you look at and which questions you ask. Feynman, the famous physicist Richard Feynman, told a story of when he was going to be drafted. He went to the draft office, and of course they checked on your reflexes and everything. And then there's the last guy. The guy decides, and then they go to the psychologist. The psychologist, and he says, at first he has three questions that are just small talk, and then he lowers his voice and says, do you think people talk about you? And he brightens up and says, sure, my mom is always saying she's always saying she was just talking about me to the neighbor. So this guy's busy writing things down. Oh, okay, yeah. Do you think people look at you? And he's all ready to say no when he says, well, for example, do you think anybody's looking at you now? Well, these guys are all waiting in line to be interviewed. And he says, there's 12 guys waiting on these chairs at the edge of the room, and there's three tables where the people are being interviewed, and there's nothing else to look at. So he does the math, and he says, well, yeah, I think maybe three people are looking at me. Oh, really? Okay, turn and look and see if that's true. So he turns and looks, and he points and says, yeah, there's that one, and that one, and that one. And now, of course, here's this table where this guy is looking and pointing, and now pretty soon, yeah, now they're all looking at me. The psychologist, he doesn't look up. He's busy writing everything down. He says, do you ever talk to yourself or something like that? Sometimes I go to my dead wife's grave and I talk to her. And he's writing this all down. And then at the end, they get to the guy who decides, the sergeant or whatever, he decides if you're in or you're out. And he wasn't taking anything for anybody. There's this fellow in front of him that had a neck, probably his neck, and the sergeant had to feel the bones in his neck for himself to make sure there's a problem. And so that he gave him this, he noticed, he looked at the paper the psychologist gave him, he said it was an F or whatever, he failed. Wasn't good enough for the Army. Okay, so it gets a lot. So he hands the sergeant the paper, and he's ready to explain, well, the guy didn't actually look up when I said people were looking at me. And so the sergeant just looks at him and says, okay, go out of here. Sergeant was just afraid of crazy people. Well, the one other thing that happened was the psychologist said, put out your hands. And so he put out his hands, but he put one hand palm up and the other palm down. And he looks at them. Says he's probably looking at them to see if they're shaking. He says, now turn them over. Now look at them. There's one palm down and one palm up. But he says he was only looking at one hand and probably didn't get the joke. So there was Feynman doing those psychologists.
Hmm.
Yeah. Gabor Mete again says, music. And I'm not quite sure how he's connecting music to addiction. He says, music gives me a sense of self-sufficiency. Music gives me a sense of self-sufficiency and nourishment. I don't need anyone or anything. I bathe in it as an amniotic fluid. It surrounds and protects me. It's also stable, ever available, and something I can control. Can reach for it whenever I want. So he's sort of comparing music to a drug here. I can also choose music that reflects my mood, or if I want, helps to soothe it. Music seeking offers excitement and tension that I can immediately resolve, and a reward that I can immediately attain, unlike other tensions in my life and other desired rewards. Music is a source of beauty and meaning outside myself that I can claim as my own without exploring how, in my life, I keep from directly experiencing those qualities. Addiction, in this sense, is the lazy man's path to transcendence. Is he also saying that music is a lazy path to transcendence, or that's the hard-working path? I'm not sure what he's saying here. Except that he likes music.
Hmm. I don't really know what the lazy man's path to transcendence. Like, yeah. I don't really, like, that's not making sense to me.
He's saying addiction is the lazy man's. Addiction is the lazy man's path to transcendence. Well, maybe because you're avoiding doing shadow work.
Oh, okay, yeah. Oh, I was like, wait, I thought you said music. I thought you said music. I'm like,
yeah.
That makes sense, but no, if addiction, okay, okay, then I misheard.
Yeah, so he's talking about music, and then all of a sudden he's talking about addiction. And it would have made more sense if he's talking about shadow work and then he's talking about addiction. That would have made more sense. It's almost like it was put together from two different quotations.
Yeah. Yeah, I was like, wait, back up. That makes no sense. Re-explain that, because that makes sense now. Okay, I got you.
So he might also be saying that music is a better thing to be addicted to than drugs, if you can switch from one to the other. Emotional competence requires the capacity to feel our emotions so that we are aware when we are experiencing stress, the ability to express our emotions effectively and thereby to assert our needs and to maintain the integrity of our emotional boundaries, the facility to distinguish between psychological reactions that are pertinent to the present situation and those that represent residue from the past. It's easy to get upset about things that happened a long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
And he's saying, well, that's not real. You need to connect with the peasants and make sure you know which is which. What we want and demand from the world needs to conform to our present needs, not to unconscious, unsatisfied needs from childhood. Distinctions between past and present blur, we will perceive loss or the threat of loss where none exists, and the awareness of those genuine needs that do require satisfaction rather than the repression for the sake of gaining the acceptance or approval of others. Stress occurs in the absence of these criteria, and it leads to this disruption of homeostasis. Chronic disruption results in ill health. And so this is one of those things that you apply not just to yourself, but when someone's angry at you because you didn't do whatever you're not fulfilling their needs. Well, is it their present needs, or is it their unconscious, unsatisfied needs from childhood? I think that...
Mm.
If you set somebody off by reminding them of their own trauma, that's when they'll get angry. Because they think they're angry about something that's happening at the present, but probably not. I had a very angry boss once, and it's taken me this long to figure out what might have been going on with him.
Mm-hmm.
In each of the individual histories of illness in this book, one or more aspect of emotional competence was significantly compromised, usually in ways entirely unknown to the person involved. Emotional competence is what we need to develop if we are to protect ourselves from the hidden stresses that create a risk to health, and it is what we need to regain if we are to heal. We need to foster emotional competence in our children as the best preventive medicine. And how you do that, of course, is another book. much, I'm sure. What they mostly do is react. Parents who realize this acquire a powerful tool. By noticing their own responses to the child rather than fixating on the child's responses to them, they free up tremendous energy for growth.
Mm-hmm.
And that was from another book, How Scattered, How Attention Deficit Disorder Originates and What You Can Do About It.
Mm-hmm.
Not the world, not what's outside of us, but what we hold inside traps us. We may not be responsible for the world that created our minds, but we can take responsibility for the mind with which we create our world. He says, the war mentality, I think he's talking about the war on drugs mentality, represents an unfortunate confluence of ignorance, fear, prejudice, and profit. I think he should have said greed, because profit is a, you know, it's ever after my expenses. The rest of the list of emotions, and profit is not emotion, but greed is. Okay. The ignorance exists in its own right and is further perpetuated by government propaganda. The fear is that of ordinary people and psychologists, propaganda, I suppose. Well, the war on drugs would be government thing. Yeah, they all work together. The fear is that of ordinary people scared by misinformation, but also that of leaders who may know better, but are intimidated by the political costs of speaking out on such a heavily moralized and charged issue. Jordan Peterson talked about Hitler being following the crowd. He would say different things, as all politicians do, and he would notice what the crowd likes. And so you try saying different things, and you keep what they like, and then you discard what they don't. And you end up he said all politicians do that, and he compared it to Trump. And he thought that Trump had too much power at the rally once and just saw, I'm not sure what he saw, security people or something, but everybody just, he thought it was just a process, somebody kind of kidding him along and believing things in a certain direction.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, the prejudice is evident in the contradiction that some harmful substances, alcohol and tobacco, are legals, while others, less harmful in some ways, are contraband. This has less to do with the innate danger of the drugs than with which populations are publicly identified with using the drugs. Now, that's a well-known thing. The history of marijuana, it's all about, you know, black people use marijuana. And cocaine also. And then when white people started using, or white people used cocaine, and then when black people invented crack cocaine, which is cheaper, all of a sudden it's a demon thing.
Mm-hmm.
Much bigger jail sentences and so on. The whiter and wealthier the population, the more acceptable is the substance and profit. If you have fear, prejudice, and ignorance, there will be profit. So, there's a lot being said there. Of course, if you work in the field of addiction, this fellow worked in the east side of Vancouver, British Columbia, which is the largest concentration of drug addicts in North America. And so he must have run into different aspects of the drug war. All addictions, whether to drugs or to non-drug behaviors, share the same brain circuits and brain chemicals. On the biochemical level, the purpose of all addictions is to create an altered physiological state in the brain. This can be achieved in many ways, drug taking being the most direct. So that addiction is never purely psychological, all addictions have a biological dimension. There's been I read about this long ago, in schizophrenics, they can tell some difference in the brain. Well, does that mean that the brain just grew funny and it causes schizophrenia, or does that mean that when you have a schizophrenic pattern, that it causes the brain to grow and develop differently?
Good question.
From the Latin word vulnerare, to wound, vulnerability is our susceptibility to be wounded. This fragility is part of our nature and cannot be escaped. The best the brain can do is to shut down conscious awareness of it when pain becomes so vast or unbearable that it threatens to overwhelm our capacity to function. The automatic repression of painful emotion is a helpless child's prime defense mechanism and can enable the child to endure trauma that would otherwise be catastrophic. He says, much of what we call personality is not a fixed set of traits, only coping mechanisms a person person acquired in childhood. Some people distinguish personality from character. I like to think of personality as like a set of clothes that you can change. You wear one set of clothes, you then you wear another, depending on where you're around. But character is how you make your decisions. Strong convictions do not necessarily signal a powerful sense of self. Very often, quite the opposite. Intensely held beliefs may be no more than a person's unconscious effort to build a sense of self to fill what underneath is experienced as a vacuum. So, again, going back to Apollo wrote about Elon Musk, he says, you ask, why? Why do you believe this? Well, because of that. Why do you that? Very, very. After a while, you get something like, why say it? Because of it. Because your mother said so, because your aunt said so, because the teacher said so, because the policeman said so. Say it because somebody said so.
Mm.
Then your beliefs can be more intensely held because they're challenged. Well, I've been saying this for so long, I must believe it. So that I have to be sure about that. Okay. Then he says, shame is the deepest of the negative emotions, a feeling we will do almost anything to avoid. Unfortunately, our abiding fear of shame impairs our ability to see reality.
I'm just moving a bunch of sticks right now, so I keep talking. I'm just going to mute it for a second so that people can actually hear you and not all these sticks rattling.
Right. He says, the very same brain centers that interpret and feel physical pain also become activated during experiences of emotional rejection. In brain scans, they light up in response to social ostracism, just as they would when triggered by a physically harmful stimuli. When people speak of feeling hurt or of having emotional pain, they're not being abstract or poetic, but scientifically quite precise. A hurt is at the center of all addictive behaviors. The wound may not be as deep and the ache not as excruciating, and it may not even be entirely hidden, but it's there. As we'll see, the effects of early stress or adverse experiences directly shape both the psychology and the neurobiology of addiction in the brain. Nature versus nurture. He says that everything is just too complex. In the real world, there is no nature versus nurture argument, only an infinitely complex and moment-by-moment interaction between genetic and environmental effects. Okay. Medical thinking usually sees stress as highly disturbing, but isolated events, such as, for example, sudden unemployment, a marriage breakup, or the death of a loved one. These major events are potent sources of stress for many, but there are chronic daily stresses in people's lives that are more insidious and more harmful than long-term biological consequences. Internally generated stresses take their toll without in any way seeming out of the ordinary. This reminds me of the old story about boiling a frog. You know, if you put a frog in boiling water, it'll jump out. But if you put a frog in a pot of cool water and you turn it up just a little bit warmer, then by the time the frog realizes the problem, it's too weak to jump out. And that's a metaphor for society. And I see it used as a metaphor for engineering teams. The problems that they really need to solve. Specifically, they talked about designing chips, and you should have a floor plan for your chip. The old way of doing it was just to say, well, the signal I need is over here, so I'll just run a wire. And you wind up with a zillion wires, and they're all disorganized. Okay. While nervous tension may be a component of stress, one can be stressed without feeling tension. And he might be saying that you don't notice it, or you might. They're actually talking about stress as a more general thing than what we normally talk about. And any kind of cognitive load, if you're trying to do arithmetic. There's a video game where for kids where there's a little arithmetic problem, 3 times 7, and it drops down from the top of the screen like Space Invaders. You're supposed to type the answer before it gets there, and it goes pop. Otherwise, it gets you. And so you're doing this cognitive work, and that is a form of stress also. We'll talk about stress. All right. It's saying, addiction is the search for oblivion, for forgetting, for the contortions we go through to not be ourselves for a few hours.
Hmm.
And he has his detractors, as everyone does. Here's an article. The seductive but dangerous allure of Gabor Mate. He is admirable but leads us down the wrong road. He was a distinguished figure in the addiction field, the author of In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts. Mate is revered for his humane medical work with inner-city drug addicts in Vancouver, centering on the Insight, I-N-S-I-T-E, injection center, where users are given works to... maybe needles and things to inject their own drugs, and Portland Hotel Community Health Society, which provides housing and lives really for the most downtrodden Vancouverites. Thank God there is such a service. Bless Mate for his work there. Mate maintains a human communion with his patients. He does so by describing his own maladies, his ADD and shopping addiction, with which he analogizes to severe drug addictions. Fair enough. It is important to recognize our common humanity. Although some may think that as a successful middle-class physician, Mate is stretching this connection. But for Mate, they are all brain diseases. Beyond this, Mate has a theory of addiction rooted in childhood abuse. Mate combines his clinical experiences with brain research, claiming the source of addiction is his probative brain chemicals. For Mate, the first 5 years of life, and even the environment in the womb, dictate the likelihood of addiction. He then relates this theoretical point of view to studies connecting stress, abuse, and lack of love and attachment to not only life problems, as they have been for some time, but to deficiencies in people's ability to process endorphins and dopamine, the neurochemicals in our bodies that provide us with both pleasure and pain relief. Mate then claims that addiction results from deficiencies, lack of receptors, in these neurosystems that cause people with addictions to self-medicate to replace their missing neurostimulation. In this sense, people are addicted to drugs as replacements for the brain chemicals their own bodies fail to process. Those addicted to things other than drugs are reacting to the same internal chemistry, but with a different external stimulus. It is important to respect Mate's work with individuals living with addictions. For this reason, people who work with clients from a harm reduction perspective, that is, they accept people as they are and seek to help those in need, deeply admire Mate. In addition, Mate's exploring the root causes of addiction may, in some sense, represent progress out of a deterministic disease concept of addiction, because it broadens the range of experiences that can lead to addiction and through which addiction expresses itself. Well, unfortunately, however, he's fluffing so much that you can tell it's coming. Unfortunately, however, Mate is fundamentally proposing a reductionist vision of addiction, where abuse history and positive biochemical changes are now the essential causes of people's self-destructive action. It is not enough to say that this model is highly conjectural. It also isn't true. That is, it makes little sense of the data. Vincent Valetti consulted a huge epidemiological study on early childhood experiences. He found that only a tiny group, 3.5%, of people with four or more adverse childhood experiences become involved in injection drug use. So Mate's model is highly undiscriminating. This percentage of addicts increases somewhat with the number of adverse experiences. Even so, this relatively minor elevation in no way presupposes the damages caused biochemically, rather than simply by detrimental psychological consequences in deeply dysfunctional homes and environments. One counter-argument in favor of Mate's position might be that injection drug use is so low among this population because so few people who have experienced abuse are exposed to injectable drugs. But this argument does not hold either. Valetti has included alcohol in his research, and with drinking, the rates of dependence follow the same trajectory, depending on the number of adverse childhood experiences, but is still not much higher for the abuse victims, 16%. Beyond this failure to find the distinct differences in addiction among abuse victims that Mate proposes, we must account for people's natural tendency to overcome abuse and addiction experiences. We might, after all, study what other protective effects for the other 96.5% of abuse sufferers that prevent them from injecting drugs, and the 84% who do not become alcohol dependent. And on top of this, what about the strong tendency that has been revealed time and again for people with addictions to naturally remediate. According to the National Institute on Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism, 3/4 of people who were at one time alcohol dependent, the large majority without treatment, many without ceasing to drink. So that throws a fly in that whole ointment. In fact, at the deepest level, Monte's views limit our approaches to our understanding of and even our respect for people living with addiction. Rather than expand our addiction, our understanding of addiction, his views harm our ability to respond to it. I guess because he's saying that there's only one cause. Right. For one thing, focusing solely on one risk factor and one very questionable source of addiction has led Monte to posit a potential cure for addiction. Ayahuasca, a brew made from South American spirit vine that is claimed to open the human consciousness for a higher degree of introspection. In fact, Monte's reliance on this treatment further confuses levels of analysis. Does introspection really remedy the absence of neuroreceptors in some straightforward manner? In this context, that harm reductionists embrace Monte is extremely troubling. For, contrary to popular beliefs in these circles, Monte is actually diverting the addiction field from a more comprehensive and practicable view of addiction. Monte's embrace of ayahuasca does not the broad harm reduction goals of expanding the resources available to people with addictions like those in Vancouver, of developing their skills for functioning in their worlds, and of holding up the hope that they can improve their lives. Instead, this approach is reductive, monosyllabic, and really no different from the disease camp's fool's gold quest for an addiction vaccine and the forlorn hope that we can remedy addiction without improving human lives. A true harm reductionist should accept a wide range of contributors in the development of addiction, but particularly those that human agency, and particularly the person who is addicted himself or herself, can address and improve. Without this sense, we are lost. That's an important paragraph. Let me do that again. A true harm reductionist should accept a wide range of contributors in the development of addiction, but particularly those the human agency, and particularly the person who is addicted himself or herself, can address and improve. That's the end of that. I have a little story about ayahuasca. First, when I read about it, I found out it tastes terrible, and therefore it's not going to be a popular recreational drug. Second, there was a case that began as a traffic stop, and they found ayahuasca in this trunk, and somehow the cop knew that it was a drug. But they said, "Oh, it's okay because that's our sacrament. We're a church. We use that just like Christians use alcohol. Nobody bothers the Christians for giving alcohol to minors. The church, you know, the church wine in the Mass to minors, the Eucharist. And so we're a church and we do the same thing." And the judge in that case, I think he rejected the argument, but he made a list, kind of questionable thing for a judge to do. He made a list of characteristics that religions have. There should be certain special days, there should be certain special clothes you're supposed to wear, there are certain foods that you're supposed to not eat, and all of that. So I read that with my interest in legal things, so that's interesting that somebody's made a checklist. You know, if you ever want to make a religion, there's a checklist of what you're supposed to have, at least in the eyes of the judges. And then sometime later, I read across their webpage, it's the Church of Ayahuasca. I'm not sure if they call it that. They're in Florida, and you can join their church and then legally partake of their ayahuasca. And yeah, you're supposed to wear white clothing if you have any, and they just made a bunch of rules. And I could just see they follow the list. So that's interesting.
That is interesting.
Here's another quotation. A tone of voice or a look in another's eyes can activate powerful implicit memories. The person experiencing this type of memory may believe that he is just reacting to something in the present, remaining completely in the dark about what the rush of feelings that floods his mind and body really represents. Implicit memory is responsible for much of human behavior, its workings all the more influential because unconscious. So I guess the questions are how do you know what you yourself are reacting to an implicit memory, and how do you know when someone else is? Couples choose with each other with an unerring instinct for finding the very person who will exactly match their own level of unconscious anxieties and mirror their own dysfunctions, and who will trigger for them all their own all our unresolved emotional pain. So I guess he's saying that couples should therapize each other. That sounds like a good idea. I don't think he's quite saying that. So self-acceptance does not mean self-admiration or even self-liking at every moment of our lives, but tolerance for all our emotions, including those that make us feel uncomfortable. He says, I do not believe that ADD leads to creativity any more than creativity causes ADD. Rather, they both originate in the same inborn trait, sensitivity. For creativity, a temperamental sensitivity is indispensable. The emotional and psychic... The sensitive individual, as we have seen, draws into herself the unseen emotional and psychic communications of her environment. On some levels of the unconscious, she will, therefore, have a deeper awareness of the world. She may also be more attuned to particular sensory input, such as sound, color, or musical tone. Thus, the sensitivity provides her with the raw materials her mind will rework and shape. The sensitivity contributes to the emergence of attention deficit disorder, as well as to creativity. Yeah, and of course, it's been pointed out that ADHD is a diagnosis for kids, mostly boys, who don't want to sit in a chair for 8 hours, which is a very unnatural thing for kids to do, to be outside running around and climbing trees. It is worth recalling here that the injudicious use of rewards and praise can be pressure tactics, no less than verbal or physical coercion. As we have seen, there are three dangers with motivating by means of reward and praise. First, they feed the anxiety that not the person, but the desired achievement is what is valued by the parent. They directly reinforce the insecurity of the ADD child. Second, since children can sense the parents' will pushing them, even if under the benign disguises such as gifts or words, counter will be strengthened. Third, praise and reward will themselves become the goal at the expense of the child's interest in the actual process of what he's doing. Children thus motivated will sooner or later learn to get by with the least amount of effort necessary to earn the praise or the reward. Shortcuts and cheating often follow. I read about this elsewhere, that somebody did an experiment with children who like doing a certain thing, and they say, now I got to reward you for doing this thing, and they get them used to that. They say, now I'm going to stop rewarding you, and then they stop being interested. More or less. Yeah, I remember when I made something out of paper when I was before kindergarten, and I showed it to my mom, and she says, "Oh, that's beautiful." But I noticed that she didn't look down from her pan. She was just saying that, assuming it was beautiful, but she was cooking, something in her pan, and didn't look down from that, as I recall. Might not be true. I was in a dance class once. She said, "Do this," and then we all did that. She said, "Very, very good." And I noticed that she wasn't looking at us. She was, because being a dance teacher, she's standing in front of us facing the same direction. But they generally do that in front of mirrors. Okay, so I don't know if that sparks anything you'd like to say, any of that, about the dangers of praise. Yeah, I've always been very parsimonious with praise. Because if somebody's doing something well, they know it. So why do they need me to tell it? The family therapist David Freeman once concluded a public lecture on intimacy in relationships by saying that if there was any one thing he hoped his audience would remember from his talk, it was the awareness that one does not know his or her spouse, his or her children. We may believe we have a perfect idea of why they act as they do, but in reality, our beliefs reflect no more than our own anxieties. Someone said it does not matter much who one marries, for in the morning it is sure to be someone else. And then after an affair, it's, you know, there's the shock of, well, I don't really know who I am or who this was. And you actually didn't know where they were all along, but you didn't notice. In other words, the shock of something unusual happening. Throughout the human lifespan, there remains a constant two-way interaction between psychological states and the neurochemistry of the frontal lobes, a fact that many doctors do not pay enough attention to. One result is the over-reliance on medications in the treatment of mental disorders. Modern psychiatry is doing too much listening to Prozac and not enough listening to human beings. People's life histories should be given as least as much importance as the chemistry of our brains. The dominant tendency is to explain mental conditions by deficiencies of the brain chemical messengers, the neurotransmitters. And here's here, Mr. Bate, or Dr. Bate, he's the guy who said that, and he's doing the same thing. I remember some audio track talking about the history of psychiatry, and it's a history of discredited treatments. But by the time a treatment is discredited, they say, they have another one. They say, oh, no, we don't do that anymore. We have this other treatment. It's much better. And it seems better until its dark side is revealed. And by that time, a decade later, they say, oh, we don't do that anymore. We have this other treatment. It's much better. And they've gone through, electroshock, lobotomies, and so on. And he's talking about Prozac and Ritalin. Saying about
what dangerous stuff.
Yeah, you know, you're supposed to make enough of it yourself, and why aren't you? And if you're not, then you add some. There's everything in your the level of everything in your body is regulated. If you don't have much serotonin or whatever, it's because something in your body thinks there shouldn't be any more than that, not because it can't make it. So if you add more, it says, oh, that's too much, and it decreases even more. So we already know that. The warmth and satisfaction of positive contact with the adult is often just as good as a psychostimulant in supplying the child's prefrontal cortex with dopamine. There are two possibilities why your memories of childhood are so hazy, I suggest to people. Either nothing happened worth remembering, or too much happened which may be hurtful to you to recall. Well, actually, I think memories naturally fade, and something happened a long time ago is going to be happy to remember that. But also your entire frame of reference is different. And you remember things in connection with your frame of reference. Your frame of reference changes. You know, the number three means something that much different to you now than it did when you were a kid. There might have been three things, there's three witches in a fairy tale, or something, whereas now you understand about arithmetic, so three means a completely different thing. As we shall see in a later chapter, human beings can tune out entire periods of their lives that were characterized by emotional pain. Well, that's depressing. That's the reason we don't. Why would we all have such painful childhoods? I met a fellow once who said he remembered being born. I don't know how often that we find.
Remember that. Being born.
Yeah.
Huh. That's like ridiculously rare. It's certainly not ridiculously common either.
Mm-hmm.
Huh. Well,
Since having a strong core self, relies on acceptance of feelings, being out of touch with the emotional side puts a person out of touch with herself. What then remains to be esteemed? Only a false self, a concoction of which we would like to imagine ourselves to be and what we have divined others want us to be. Sooner or later, people come to realize that this false self, wanting to think what they should want, what they should feel, does not work for them. When they look inside themselves, they discover a frightening emptiness, a vacuum, an absence of a true self or of intrinsic motivation. I thought he was going to say what appears to be a finding emptiness. As parents, we may as well accept that we'll lose it at times. Perfect equanimity is beyond us. Temporary breaks in the relationship with the child are inevitable and are not in themselves harmful unless they are frequent and catastrophic. The real harm is inflicted when the parent makes the child work at reestablishing contact, as in forcing a child to apologize before granting forgiveness. Puts forgiveness in scare quotes, meaning it's not really forgiveness at all if you have to work for it. Throws shade on Christianity, because you've got to do something for this forgiveness. Environmental influences also affect dopamine. From animal studies, we know that social stimulation is necessary for the growth of the nerve endings that release dopamine and for the growth. Well, you know, everything in the body develops by use. If there's anything like if you can't use your arm, it won't develop. So it's no surprise if all your brain chemicals need your brain to be active in order to develop properly. In four-month-old monkeys, major alterations of dopamine and other neurotransmitter systems were found after only 6 days of separation from their mothers. In these experiments, writes Stephen Guy, loss of an important attachment appears to lead to less of an important neurotransmitter in the brain. Once these circuits stop functioning normally, it becomes more and more difficult to activate. A neuroscientific study published in 1998 showed that adult rats whose mothers had given them more licking, grooming, and other physical emotional contact during infancy had more efficient brain circuitry for reducing anxiety, as well as more receptors on nerve cells for the brain's own natural tranquilizing chemicals. In other words, early interactions with the mother shaped the adult rat's neurophysiological capacity to respond to stress. I remember a professor saying that the Journal of Psychology really ought to be called the Journal of Rat Psychology because so many of the articles are about rats. Okay. And he keeps saying more of the same thing you would expect along that line. He thinks that ADD may equally stand for attunement deficit disorder. Dopamine release from the midbrain also triggers the growth of nerve cells and blood vessels in the right prefrontal cortex and promotes the growth of dopamine receptors. A relative scarcity of such receptors in blood supply is thought to be one of the major physiological dimensions of ADD. Well, the lesson here is you should have an active mind and active brain while you're young, and the rest of the time also. So that's a short way of saying all that. ADD is also found more commonly in people whose first-degree relatives are alcoholics or suffer from depression, anxiety, addiction, and obsessive-compulsive disorder, or Tourette syndrome. Well, Tourette syndrome, I do know, is a genetic thing. Okay, so we're now at 8:30. I suppose I should start out a guided meditation. Let's begin by stretching. So the body is so important. Let's stand up and reach toward the ceiling. And reach toward the walls. Every direction. Front and back. Roll your shoulders. And your legs, I'm not sure. Move your feet around to stretch everything. And find a quiet place you can relax. And focus on your breathing. I haven't got my script in front of me.
There we go.
I have some notes about how relaxation works. Passive relaxation occurs naturally when muscles are at rest and not being actively used. And there are other reflexes that help muscles relax by reducing muscle tension. It's one of them when you are about to overuse a muscle, when you're very strong, it keeps you from hurting yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's our muscles come in opposing pairs, and the nerve that pulls on one also inhibits the other and causes that to relax.
Mm-hmm.
So I like a back and forth, gentle back and forth movement to relax muscles. And so, for example, you nodding your head. You could start by the ceiling of the sky and looking down and stressing the muscles in both directions. Looking up and looking down. We have to fight gravity with our necks and shoulders instead of those muscles. And then you pull up tension. You can stretch those and then smaller and smaller. Move up and down, nodding. Smaller and smaller movement. Until you're just barely nodding. And then imagine nodding. And you can imagine nodding or muscles will continue to work just a tiny bit. Down. Let's move the head a different direction. Shake side to side. So look to your left. Stretch that way. Look to your right. And stretch that way. And lift again. Not quite so far. Right again. By the way, when a joint pops, if we were doing a kind of a chiropractic thing, if we were just the stretching back and forth is different from a prolonged stretch. If you're doing a prolonged stretch, then I would say once you get a pop, generally people are satisfied with that because something happened and they stop. But according to me, a pop is when your bones are no longer stuck together. And that means the forces that used to go through the bones are now going through the soft tissues, the muscles on either side, which means that after the pop, you're now getting a different stretch. Now stretching mm-hmm. something you wasn't stretching before. So if you continue stretching, sometimes you affect another pop. Of course, if you take that too long, if you stretch too long, then your muscles on the other side will start to get cramped up. So you need to back and forth when you're stretching. So moving left to right, and smaller and smaller. Barely moving at all. Imagine looking left to right. You move your eyes to the left to the right. As you move your eyes, you can help move your head a little bit as well. So that will help you. Looking left to right. And looking up and down. And we can move the head another direction. And that is lifting one ear up and the other ear down. And that reverse movement we don't make very often. Back and forth. And again, smaller and smaller movement. Smaller and smaller movement. Up and down. Especially if you move your head back, like muscles you really don't use very often. You can really feel it in the back of your neck and your upper back. Again, picking like a bird, smaller and smaller. And imagine picking like a bird. You can move your right ear towards the wall or whatever is over there. And move your left ear towards the wall. And move your right ear towards the wall. Move your left ear towards the wall. That movement, smaller and smaller. But they still imagine going that way. And there's one more way we can move, and that's up and down. Now you might say, well, if I've got my spine can't get longer. And your spine has an S-curve in it. So if you try to move your head towards the ceiling, towards the sky, you can move up and down just a little bit. And what's happening is the S-curve in your spine is getting straighter and more curved. So you can move if you get about half an inch taller and shorter. And that's all different set of muscles. Imagine moving up and down, getting taller and shorter. Now we can focus on our feet. toes. And you could move your feet up and down as if you're a frog dance with your water movements within your toes. And finally, you complete the imagining within your toes. And during this process, you may notice tension in other muscles, other unnecessary tension in the shoulder or an arm or something. So just go ahead and focus on that for a moment and let that go. And you can move your knees back and forth. You can imagine walking. If you imagine walking, your muscles will move a tiny bit. Imagine that we're up hiking in the mountains or in the desert or on the beach walking along. And walking through a forest with sunlight and birds and all those things. Self imagining walking just maybe a symbol of relaxation like sand passing through a funnel. You know, you grab a handful of sand at the beach and squeeze it and let it go, and there's an image of relaxation. We can have that same feeling in our legs as the sand is running out. And now we can wiggle our fingers. Same thing, we can move our hands a little and move our wrists into a circle. Just like you every muscle that we used before, I mean, you can use all day. And we can pull these circles smaller and smaller. Put their hands down at rest and imagine moving like that. Imagine the different movements we make during the day, maybe picking things up. And hands smaller and larger and open and closed. Making a fist, making a bad hand. Imagine all those movements. And we may feel as if there's sand running out like sand. Feel our shoulders. Feel sand running out of our shoulders. And, picture a speed of relaxation, a place of peace and rest. Some place you've been that you thought what you want to do tomorrow. And even though it seems like physical work, you could be as relaxed as possible while doing it. And that will be beneficial. So you might be digging a ditch or building a rock wall or something, and every muscle other than the ones you're using are going to be relaxed. It's just like relaxing everything now. And if you need to deal with people, you can deal with them in a way that's relaxed, and they don't get you upset. Just stay focused and balanced and centered and grounded and deal with things as they come along. And then, what is it that we want for tomorrow? What is it that we want? If we were to transport ourselves in time, so it is now tomorrow morning instead of tomorrow evening instead of night, it's going to be different. What did we get done, and what gives us a feeling of satisfaction about tomorrow? And how does that help us for the future and the next day? We can focus on one thing instead of several of them, and you'll be more relaxed and focused and balanced. And if you're really well-practiced, you can focus on zero things, focus on nothing at all. That's the ultimate Zen, is to focus on nothing whatsoever. You could focus on just one. It could be a sensation. It's what you feel like at the tip of your nose. Or it could be a word, a symbol. It could be some idea. It could be some memory that pops up, whatever. Whatever memory presents it to yourself, you can focus on that one thing. And you can take something complicated you know, what are all the things that happened today. You can wrap them up in one little package, and that'll be one thing. And notice any sensations in the body that come to your attention. You know, generally, it means something else. You should be relaxed. Let the body and the mind work together. There was a martial artist who spent 30 years studying martial arts. And he said, the first 10 years, I thought it was all about the body, training the body. And then for the second 10 years, I thought it was all about training the mind. 10 years, I'm not sure there's a difference. So we could breathe deeply. And we can feel the air going in all the way. It's easy to feel the air in your nose. It's more difficult to feel the air in your throat. Maybe if it's really cold, you could feel the air coming in and out of your lungs and let it out. And notice all the sensations. And then a deep breath. And hold it. And let it out. Breathing in peace and happiness. And breathe out all the stress and worry. And all the things that keep us from being in touch with ourselves. Breathing in everything good and breathing out all the pain. Feel your heart beating. You can pay attention to your pulse. Maybe you could feel that pulse farther away from your heart, maybe not just in your chest, you could feel it other places. Sometimes I can feel my pulse in my feet. Maybe you could feel your pulse in your hands, your forehead. Some nature sounds here.
Well, Rod, I hate to cut this short. However, Blog Talk is screaming at me saying that we got 90 seconds left. So I want to say thank you for coming on the radio show again, and thank you for taking us through another meditation and sharing a lot of interesting information with us. This was actually really good. I really enjoyed it. So, yeah, this was good. Just letting everybody know that next Friday I will not be here. I will be at the city burying my dad's ashes, saying the final farewell to my father. So I will see you guys not next week, but the week after. And I might be calling you from a combine. We'll have to see how things go. Thank you again, Rod, and thank you to Pixie who came on the show today. I will see you guys again in 2 weeks from now, Friday. Have a very happy Friday. Bye, guys.